already, covered a lot on, on these topics. I know you've done the covariant derivative. I think you did a bit on the Lie derivative, is that right? Yeah. But not so much forms. No. A little bit. Okay. So, well, I always think it's useful to see things again anyway, but by the end of today, I'm going to just, after the second lecture, I'm just going to sort of come around and just try and do a little bit of a field poll to get an impression about speed and the pacing of things. Because while, I don't want you to get bored by things going slow, on the other hand, I think if you get a thorough, if you prepare the foundations thoroughly, then it's much easier to progress. Yeah. So here, and also actually, I like to kind of motivate some of the definitions by thinking about why did people do what they do? How do you get there? So in this lecture, I'm focusing on the Lie derivative. We looked at the Lie bracket right at the end of Monday's lecture, but here we're actually talking about the Lie derivative. The Lie bracket's a particular algebraic operation. It takes you from TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. So it's just a commutator of vectors. This is something far more general, or will be by the time we finish with it. And so in order to both, we'll come back to this thought as well with the connection, but in order to think about what you mean by derivatives of geometric objects, I'm just going to say, let's just think what we mean by a derivative. So when you first meet derivatives, you're kind of meeting them as a limit. You're sort of saying, well, it's like a rate of change, but you look at an object a little time or parameter, increment delta t onwards, you subtract where it is at t, and then you divide by delta t. You take the limit as delta t goes to zero. As long as that's well defined, then that is your derivative. So we're basically going to do this for the Lie derivative, but we have to address what is q of t plus delta t? How do we do this operation minus? And indeed, what actually is t and t plus delta t? So these are all the different aspects that we have to think about. So in general, so what I want to do is I want to have this Q being a vector, a covector, or a tensor, or whatever, which means it actually lives in the tangent bundle or cotangent bundle or product thereof of the manifold. But I'm first going to just say a little bit about what do we mean by T and T plus delta T. So our manifold is multidimensional. So this is just a real derivative. So how am I going to translate this type of expression to a multidimensional manifold? So in other words, this is sort of asking, what is t plus delta t, or indeed, what is t? So unless q is a scalar, I can't really compare q at nearby points. So we might sort of want to replace t by p, and t plus delta t by sort of p plus delta p, where p and p plus delta p are points on a manifold. But of course, the tangent spaces at P and P plus delta P are not the same vector space. So we need to connect these together. So in order to do this, I'm going to take a little detour and talk a bit about coordinate transformations. So these here, this is a curve gamma. This may be my point P. My tangent vector is T. And so this here is P plus delta P. So that's moving just a little bit in the manifold. And so here, I'm just going to introduce a bit of nomenclature because we're going to be kind of using this concept. I'm sort of thinking about focusing in on this point P, and I imagine I have, obviously I have my tangent space, but I have a curve gamma going through P, which has its tangent vector T all the way along that gamma. And then I've got another gamma, let's call it gamma naught, gamma one, gamma two, and I imagine that I sort of integrate up. But at all points, I define a vector field T essentially, such that at all points, it is tangent to this family of curves. So these gammas are called the integral curves of T. So in essence, what we're doing here is we're linking nearby points in a very specific way, to be sure, but we're linking them. So this is a way of interpreting T and T plus delta T, where T corresponds to some point P, one of these integral curves, and P plus delta P is just a little bit further along the curve, gamma. Remember, the curve was a map from the reals into the manifold. So if you like, that's R. This is T, which maps to P. And this is T plus delta T. And that maps to P plus delta P on that curve. Writing epsilon for small numbers. So really, obviously P plus delta P is some Taylor series in delta T, but the first term is just a linear term. So as we approach P along this integral curve, we get a better approximation to its coordinates in the local chart by just taking x, the coordinates of P, and just adding a little bit of T. So what in essence we're doing is we're using our tangent vector or a vector field to define a local coordinate transformation. So we can think of this as just relabeling all the points along in the manifold that are along those curves, or we can actually think about it as sort of pushing along the curve. which is a sort of either an active or a passive way of viewing it. So now if I just come back to the thought of taking this derivative, so I've got my tangent vector here, got my tangent vector there. Then if I have a different vector field, S, I have some value of S here. So I've got a sort of S which is living at each point in the manifold locally in the tangent plane. I can now think of not just having what the value of S is there, but I can also think of doing a coordinate transformation on my vector field S and comparing what I get with that coordinate transformation that's defined by sliding, if you like, along the integral curves of T. So we're sort of moving towards actually defining that Q of t plus delta t and Q of t, because the Q of t plus delta t will be its actual value at p plus delta p. And then this Qt is going to be what we get when we do this coordinate transformation. So just to get there, I'm going to do a little bit of formalism on the manifold. So let's suppose we have two manifolds, M and N, with dimension M and dimension N. Then I can make a map, or I can have a map potentially between M and N. Now, that map might be onto, which is quite likely if n is less than m. It might be 1-to-1, which means that if something in n is in the image of f, I've got a unique pre-image sitting in m. But what I'm really interested in is when they have the same dimensionality and I can go both ways. So here, this is my point P, which maps to some point Q in N. I look in a local chart. So I have a map here to X mu. And I have a map here, which is Y nu. So these maps here are just local charts. They're there because these are manifolds. But then I also induce a map between R to the M and R to the N. And once we're down in R to the N, we know what we're doing, okay? Because we have all the structure of a local flat space. Thank you. So again, I suspect you already did this, but just to reiterate, if f is 1 to 1 onto C infinity, etc., then we say f is a diffeomorphism. And what that's really just saying is it's just a way of deforming the manifold, or at least deforming the way that you're labeling the manifold, but not actually changing it physically, or what that would be how we would say it as physicists. So locally, we're really just changing coordinates, in essence. So how does this link in with my aim of defining a derivative? Well, I want to link tangent spaces. So let me start by showing just how you map the tangent vector space of M onto the tangent vector space of N. So here we have M, or gamma, P, and T, S. Here we've got N, U, gamma primed, and this, of course, is our map. So it's, again, I've stepped back because at the moment I'm just interested in what we can do generally. So remember that our vector is a map, C infinity of M, to C infinity of M, and it takes a function F, which is a map from the reals into the manifold, and it maps it to df by ds at the point P. Well, if I have a map here, gamma, from the reals into M, I can therefore build a map gamma primed from the reals into N by simply going up into M and then going across to N using my map F. And then once I've got a curve in N, I know how to take the tangent vector. And so I identify my tangent vector in N, T, with the tangent vector in M, S. So that's how I get my map. I get a vector in N from a vector in M. So again, this exists in general, even when the dimensionality is different. But obviously, if it's the same and we have a diffeomorphism which can go in either direction, then that means I can also map back over the tangent planes of N into the tangent planes of M. That's the vector map. What about covectors? Wrong way around. Well, remember, our covectors are just a linear map from the tangent space down into the reals. And so if we have a covector in N, we have a map from TQ of N down to the reals. And then we just can take the pre-image, the vector over here that corresponds to the vector here, and thereby define a linear map from the vector over here to the reals. So that's just schematically, you know, in terms of maps, what we're doing. And again, you know, this is for general M and N, general dimensionality. But if we are with a diffeomorphism within manifolds at the same dimension, then that means we can also take the cotangent space of M and put it to the cotangent space of N.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Being infinitely differentiable for like the condition for diffeomorphism, is it necessary to define push-forward and pullbacks, or like we can?
I don't think infinitely differentiable is necessary. I think, you know, as I was saying on Monday, to a large extent, I've just taken that to make things easy, make life easy. Because typically in physics, we're modeling things, and we're modeling things with usually differential equations. And so we like things to be differentiable. Now, it's not to say that things don't jerk around in reality, but you know, at least from the perspective of gravity, we're actually dealing in general relativity with a continuum. And if our sort of physical space truly was not continuous, then we would not, you know, that sort of doesn't necessarily correspond to the sort of physics situations that we think we're dealing with. Now, that said, there are plenty of physical objects where we actually approximate them by some sort of discontinuity, and it often works very, very well. But rather, because I just want to make life easy, I'm sticking with infinite differentiability. I don't know offhand how things change, but I suspect, again, it is, you probably, do you know, you know, what level of differentiability you've got to have for these? I would think at least C1.
For tangent mass, probably C1. For C2.
Yeah. Sounds plausible.
I haven't checked if there are.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think you need a real mathematician. I'm just an imposter.
So just defining the diffeomorphism differentiable up to C2.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've just put C infinity because I'm dealing with C infinity manifolds. But I think you're probably right. Yeah. I don't know whether I'm particularly brutal with chalk or if it's the chalk, but it always seems to break for me. So the line of thought, I guess, sort of at the top right or middle left, the line of thought was about how vector fields generated these coordinate transformations, which are just isomorphisms locally. But they provide a very specific map. So again, I guess, you know, I often think of this as just literally sort of pushing something along on these integral curves, or you know, sort of sliding, like sliding beads along a string. That's one way of thinking about it, where your bead is a point. So that's sort of thinking about these coordinate transformations. So there will be these push forwards and pull backs, but of course they are specific because this whole story is happening along the integral curves of your tangent vector t. So again, returning to this picture here, I can go from p to p plus delta p by just sliding along the integral curve, but then I can also push forward my s using this push forward map. So my vector s, which is a geometric object, so this is equal to the components s mu d by dx mu, which is s mu d by dy mu. So this is using this concept of the basis that we developed last time. And this is a coordinate basis. So I can decompose my s either in terms of the basis of x defined by the x mu or those defined by the y mu. And so my new coordinates, if you like, s nu, are s mu dy I dx. So a lot of the time, I mean, I'm writing it as exact. It's not exact. It's just the leading approximation. So there's obviously order epsilon squared pieces. And so this is just the original components plus a term of order epsilon or delta t, whatever, times the derivative of t in the direction of s. So that's just saying what my s nu are. And so now I want to compare this to the actual value of s at t plus delta t. So again, I'm really bringing into action here things that we know about the underlying R to the n manifold spaces. So here, this is what the actual value of S is at P plus delta P. So I'm just sort of using, you know, the structure on R to the n. So now I feel that I'm in a position to define the Lie derivative So the Lie derivative of S at the point P with respect to the underlying vector field T, so WRT means with respect to. And so I literally take over this definition, but I now write it in terms of these geometric things. I take the vector field S evaluated at P plus delta P. I subtract off the S at P pushed forward to P plus delta P. And then I take the limit as delta T goes to zero. So remember that this delta P is related to the delta T. So here, P is like X naught mu. P plus delta P is X naught mu plus delta T T. So those are the values of those, the coordinates of those points on, in the local chart. And so in components, well, I said what S of P plus delta P was. So I have S naught mu So those are the components of my S at P plus delta P. I've then got to subtract the push forward, which is the one just above it. And then I divide by delta T. So you see that the S naughts cancel. Yep.
So is this just for a specific curve, or is this for, is this like a general?
So this, the curves are the integral curves of T. So it is a, if you think about a dog and a dog's coat, so you think of the if you comb a sort of wet, or it's getting quite bizarre, but you know, when you, if you run a comb, you know, through the, you know, a dog's hair when it's wet, you'll sort of see how it makes these grooves, yeah, and so you have very definite lines. So that's how to visualize the integral curves, but these cover the whole of the two-dimensional surface of the skin, the coat, right? And so it's one way of combing the dog, and you could try combing it a slightly different way. I can see some puzzled faces. Maybe you don't have dogs, but, and so that, so each of those different ways of combing is a different set of integral curves and therefore a different vector field. So we are taking at this point, this here, I'm taking this is evaluated at P, but I can do it at any P along any of those integral curves. So I'm just, first of all, getting the expression for what this is at P. And so when I divide by delta T, I see it's this. But that doesn't have any, you know, this is evaluated at P because that's the Lie derivative at P, but there's no attachment to P there. So that P could have been anywhere along any of the integral curves. So I can then take this expression that I've evaluated at a given point and I see, okay, well, actually, that doesn't have any, you know, it's not tied to that individual point just as an expression. And so I can sort of say that that is my coordinate definition of this Lie derivative across the manifold. But if you remember, this is very new. This was the expression of the Lie bracket of T and S. So I start off by just being very pedantic, very pedestrian, looking at what happens at a given point. But then I realize, well, I was just taking this as an example point, so I can do this for any point. So this is my general rule or expression. This is my method, procedure, for finding the Lie derivative of one vector with respect to another. And then I'm just going to leave it as an example to you to derive the corresponding expression for the Lie derivative of a covector. So our Lie bracket was only an operation on vectors. It took two vectors and gave you a vector back. The Lie derivative can act on anything. So I just,
Sorry, I'm a bit confused on the top board. In the second to last line, we have the derivative on the T, but in the final line, we have the derivative on the S.
Yeah, they're two different things. The first one is that push forward. So I guess I first of all motivated it by saying that perhaps it's more of a passive type of approach to the coordinate transformation. But I wanted this S, S at the point P, or is I can decompose it with respect to a coordinate basis. And I can decompose it with respect to the X chart or the Y chart. Now, the Y chart, I'm going to then say, is the one that I've obtained by this sliding along the integral curves, okay? So this, if you like, that going from the bottom on the left to the top two lines on the right is a more mechanical way of doing this push forward. Because what it's saying is that I have my vector S, which I can either have in my X coordinates. The X coordinates are the tangent space at P, that's my picture here, or I can, my Y coordinates were the coordinates here of the tangent space at P plus delta P. So if you like, the manifold M is the one that's centered on P, the manifold N is centered on P plus delta P. And so I can either express it in a coordinate basis of the X's or a coordinate basis of the Y's. And in essence, that is saying the same thing as the push forward, but in a different way. Here, this is all about maps, you know, and not an index in sight. Whereas what I've written there is saying, is thinking much more about nuts and bolts. You know, what's my coordinate, original coordinate basis, what's my new one, and how do I get between the two? It's, I guess also that's more of the active interpretation of the literally pushing forward. This is slightly passive of thinking, of it as a relabeling of coordinates. So it just, it's sort of, you know, one of those things that just, you know, sometimes needs to click. I'm not, it's definitely, it's not like it's totally, you know, straightforward. But the bottom line is then actually asking, forgetting about the fact we've got the X's and Y's, it's saying I've got a vector field S, which means I've got a value of S in every single tangent plane on the manifold. So that's called, I guess, as a dissection of the tangent bundle, because it's just a vector at each point on the manifold. So they're obviously in different tangent spaces, formally speaking. But once I'm down in R to the N, in R to the N, we have a very natural, I mean, in essence, it's the flat connection. You know, if you think about it from the intuition of the full machinery of GR. So I know how to move the vectors around, yeah? I just do that partial differentiation. So I literally say, yes, I've got the vector pointing that way at P plus delta P. So I kind of, you know, I know, I mean, that the vector here is just equal to, you know, the vector there times a sort of partial derivative.
Sorry, I still am confused as to how you derived the last equation there. The one line above the last, it's clear, but so you replace S with T.
I should have drawn lines and made it clear. I'd started a slightly different track of thought. So let me get a different color here. Let me draw the line. Yep. Boom, 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 boom. Okay. So this is the push forward done from a different, you know, a more mechanical approach. But we're using now that, so that's, if you like, the QT on that expression. But now I'm going to compare it with S at P plus delta P. So this is just like saying, you know, F of, you know, F of T plus delta T is F of T plus delta T, F primed of T, etc. Yeah? But because we're in R to the N, we have to take the rate of change of S in all of the different directions. So it's kind of, if you like, you stop one line of thought there, and then you start a new line of thought. So I think the way I laid it out made it more confusing than it should have been. Okay. So quite often what we see with the Lie derivative is it's sort of related to things to do with coordinates or symmetries. And so I'm just going to give I'm not going to belabor the point, but if I move a little bit square, a little bit S along the integral curve of S, and then I go along T, so that's my origin, that's point A, that's point B, this is using the idea of the commutator, then I go a distance T along the origin, and I get the point C. And then I go a distance S along the vector S, and I get to the point D. So what the Lie bracket actually does, I mean, you can see from that picture and the way I described the process, it's a commutator. I'm going along one integral curve of one of S, then T, versus the integral curve of T, then S. And this, what the Lie bracket does, is it basically tells you how to get between those two endpoints. So if it does commute, it sort of turns out that we can find coordinates that are related to the vector fields S and T, or if we actually, it turns out if we have many vector fields which close to give you a Lie algebra, then you can find they sort of span a surface which has a dimensionality either equal to the number of vector fields or less. You can find, and you can coordinatize it. So I'll just give you an indicator of how the coordinates at A, or the coordinates of the point A, are the same as the coordinates at naught. So I'm doing a Taylor expansion here. So the subscript naught just means of everything evaluated at the origin O. So I have to go up to second order because this is a second order effect. And so to get to XB, I go along from XA along T. But now I then want to transport that expression back to the origin. So my XA is X naught. My T is at A is T naught plus the first derivative, and I've already got to second order in S and T, so I don't need to go any further, and this is already second order. So I can just say that that's the same as that quantity evaluated at the origin. But if I go in the other direction, so the expression for the coordinates of D is obtained just by simply swapping out the S's and the T's. So it's X naught plus TT plus a half T squared T derivative of T plus S capital S plus TS the derivative of T along, sorry, of S along T. So XD, going to leave this to you to verify. So here, so I'm kind of going to, you know, leave you to just verify that afterwards, in all the time that you have. Lots of time, I'm sure. So that's one kind of geometric picture we have with the Lie derivative. And then the other one, probably got enough time to do a full board, so I better clean it. Well, the other thing the Lee derivative is good for is when you start thinking about symmetries of your metric. So again, I'm slightly hopping forward here because I know you've met metrics in the first part, your first GR course. But the Lee derivative, if you have a vector field along which the Lee derivative of your metric vanishes, then the integral curves of that vector field tell you are sort of symmetries of the metric. So in other words, you use this definition here, appropriately defined, for your metric, and you get the fact that the Lee derivative of the metric vanishes, or in other words, G is constant along integral curves of K. So a very simple example is the two-sphere with the canonical metric. And I take my Killing vector. I'm going to demonstrate to you that d by d phi is a Killing vector. So I look at the components, so L, K of G, mu nu. So I have to take, where is it? It's probably hiding behind this. So I have to take the expression that we derived for the covectors. And the rule when you've got a tensor is essentially that you just do, you start off with the partial derivative of the object along the vector, and then you take each index in turn. And sort of sum over it and replace it with the derivative of the of the original Killing vector. So that's the component expression for the derivative of the metric. Now, because K is just d by d phi, that's just 0, 1, all right? So when you take the partial derivative of K, that vanishes because it's a constant. And then if I look here, this is just d by d phi of the components of G. And because you don't see a phi anywhere in the metric components, that is zero. So that tells you that d by d phi is a Killing vector field. And we kind of have our intuitive knowledge of that because d by d phi just rotates the sphere. It doesn't do anything. I mean, it looks the same. So I think given that it's 10 o'clock, I won't sort of put any more material down, but I'll just talk about where we're going next. The Lee derivative, below the Lee derivative itself, is the way I motivated it was just by saying, hey, let's try and look at what we, how we originally define a derivative when we first meet it and see if we can construct something that follows the same structure on the manifold, what we see is, at least when it comes to the vectors and the Lie bracket, we see this story of asymmetry or of a commutator. So we learn that if we take some sort of anti-symmetric derivative, we seem to be okay with partial derivatives. And so on Monday, when I was sort of showing about why the simple thing that you do with partial derivatives in a local chart doesn't work, the bit by which it didn't work was the second derivative of the coordinate transformation, if you like, d squared y by dx dx. And so that is symmetric in the xx part. And so if we can find a way of anti-symmetrizing, then we kind of get rid of the non-geometric parts of partial differentiation. So what we'll do this afternoon is we'll look at forms which are anti-symmetric co-tensors, covariant objects. So in other words, they're maps from vector spaces into the real. So they are objects with all the indices downstairs, but they're completely anti-symmetric. And as long as we always stay within this family of objects that are totally anti-symmetric, it turns out we can define a derivative map that is not now, you know, here we our Lie derivative acts on a tensor and gives you back a tensor of the same type. It took the metric, which was a rank two covariant tensor, it gives you back a rank two covariant tensor. Whereas, you know, in essence, when we meet grad, div, and curl, grad takes you from a scalar to a vector, right? It gives you more. And so what you'll see with D is it gives you more. It takes you from something which has, say, one index to two. So it takes you from a rank one covariant object to rank two. And so we find a way of doing differentiation of geometric objects, no metric, but a price we pay is that we can only stick with anti-symmetric objects. So that's what we'll do this afternoon. Stop there.
Questions? How do you generalize the Lie derivative for a tensor?
So I haven't. I haven't actually done it. So that can be an exercise. If you make a rank two covariant tensor by just taking, something that's like, you know, omega mu epsilon nu, you know, so you sort of tack together two. This is how you form a tensor product, right? You start off by taking two covectors, and then you kind of take the spanning space of all things of this format. And so if you took, you know, you use the fact that a derivation has the Leibnizian property. So this would be, so L of omega tensor, this epsilon would be L of omega tensor epsilon plus omega tensor L of epsilon, right? Just schematically. So that's kind of how you get it.
But when I compare this to the Lie derivative for a vector,
got the plus.
There's something minus something. Mm-hmm. But here,
I'm giving you another exercise now. Your classmates are going to. Okay, how do you get that? So in that case, what I'm going to say is that the Lie derivative of omega v, yeah, this is a scalar now. Yep. So this is just equal to, let's do it with respect to k, it's k mu d by dx mu of the scalar, right? But now you use Leibniz. This has to be equal to the Lie derivative of omega contracted acting on v plus omega Lie v right? Where now this is Lie on a covector, Lie on a vector. You can probably see how, if you've a minus sign here, you better have a plus one there so that you end up with that there. Okay. There you go. It's another exercise. You're gonna have so much time before the lecture. Okay.